kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great folks like you. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, so now is a great time to join us. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, please go to kboo.fm/give or simply text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, and have a great night.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to the KBOO News In-Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Oppenheimer was one of the biggest films of the year, and in its wake comes the documentary Downwind. We're speaking with Mark Shapiro, the co-director of the film. It's the story of real people who live downwind of the Nevada nuclear test site and how radioactive fallout has impacted their lives. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today. To start out with here, what is Downwind about and who are the Downwinders?
Well, Downwind is chronicles the Nevada test site where from 1951 to 1992, the United States detonated nearly 1,000 nuclear weapons of the Oppenheimer size at the Nevada test site. And Downwinders are the people that were impacted directly from the fallout or the radioactive clouds that went east of, you know, the Nevada test site, which is 65 miles from Las Vegas. So downwinders tend to be people in Utah, Arizona, Nevada. But we find out from the film as we dig deeper that we're all downwinders because the jet stream sort of goes, you know, capriciously and it impacts people all over the country. And downwinders can be in really any state, any part of the world where there's nuclear testing or nuclear waste nearby.
What have been some of the health impacts of these? I think you cite them in the film, these 928 nuclear explosions that you document.
Right. There were 928 nuclear weapons detonations that were documented in the United States. And of course, it was happening in other parts of the world, too, Kazakhstan and Russia and China. But the impacts of radiation, mainly obviously people talk about cancer, leukemia, and other illnesses known to be plausible from exposure to radiation.
As a documentary filmmaker, how did you personally get interested in the fallout in Nevada and in this nuclear test site?
My co-director and I, Doug Miller, have both been impacted by cancers in our family, not necessarily downwind, but by cancer. And we're also in the film world. And we came to this story because we'd read about this John Wayne movie called The Conqueror, which was made in St. George, Utah, about 135 miles from the Nevada test site. This is a John Wayne movie. And half of the cast and crew of The Conqueror years later died of cancer and other related illnesses. And people talk about, oh, well, people smoked and everything back then. But this is a really highly proportionate number of people who died from cancer. And so we dug deeper. And as we went to St. George, we spent a lot of time in Utah and in Nevada talking to downwinders, and we decided to sort of use John Wayne as almost like an icon of American strength or ironic strength. And you know, as we pulled the lens back, we discovered that you know these radioactive tests, these nuclear tests were damaging to everyone, and John Wayne was sort of used as we sort of felt like he was an icon and someone that was, you know, represented sort of this brash American spirit. and we find out later, of course, what happened to him and the others in the film, as well as the downwinders.
The documentary also looks at, kind of continuing this in this vein, at the 1990 Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which was supposed to allow victims of radiation exposure to get funds for their treatment. So this is more than 30 years on. Can you kind of briefly describe what has that act looked like in practice?
Yes. Yeah, so the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, which is scheduled, by the way, to sunset in 2024, provides a one-time lump sum amount of $50,000 if a downwinder can prove that they developed cancer from the Nevada test site and the testing that took place in America. There's also a uranium component. We focus mainly on the Nevada test site here, but folks can go to, they have their own website. It's a government website that, you know, has put together funding for downwinders. Now, we asked every one of the people we interviewed, and we interviewed probably 50 or 60 people, ended up with 13 for the movie. But we asked them, you know, $50,000, what does that say to you? And nearly everyone scoffs at the idea that you can sort of put a money amount against some, you know, someone or some people, a family that's been impacted by this nuclear testing. However, RECA in itself is a start. It's an admission of guilt on the United States government's part, but it doesn't go far enough because RECA only covers three states right now currently, which is Arizona, Nevada, and Utah. And it doesn't even include people, downwinders in New Mexico, where Oppenheimer's, you know, bomb was made so famous in Trinity. People in New Mexico are not covered by RECA. And a lot of people actually are turned away because of, you know, various things on the application. The application is also, it's a lengthy application. A lot of people who live in adjacent communities, Native American communities, don't really have full access to these documents. So we're hoping also to raise awareness that RECA is still here. It's still available. However, again, it's supposed to sunset in June of 2024.
Mark, you mentioned your film taking on, you know, describing the story of the impact, the fallout of John Wayne's film, the Conqueror, and all the cast and crew that were affected, you know, by radiation. I know your film also features one of John Wayne's sons, Patrick. It also has more notable names in the film. Matthew Modine is an executive producer. Martin Sheen is the narrator. Michael Douglas appears in the film. Also, the comedian Lewis Black. Can you describe briefly some of their connections to this issue?
Yeah, it was really important for us, you mentioned the Hollywood names, to include who we considered to be the most significant activists in the downwind community, and that included the Hollywood names that you mentioned. But it goes beyond that. We actually had folks like Mary Dixon and Claudia Peterson, Ian Zabarte, who's the principal man of the Western bands of the Shoshone Nation. Those people have been speaking out against nuclear testing and the impacts of nuclear testing, and have been advocates for, you know, stopping nuclear testing. And, you know, we wanted to include significant names, the people in this film, and tell the story in black and white with facts about, you know, the individuals that were impacted. And so it was really important for us to connect the dots. So Michael Douglas, obviously, the China Syndrome. Martin Sheen was arrested many times at the Nevada test site protesting side by side with all the names I just mentioned. Lewis Black, we brought in Lewis Black as a political satirist because he talks about duck and cover and sort of how ridiculous it was that, you know, you could hide under your desk at school to avoid nuclear radiation. And then, you know, while we were interviewing Lewis Black in New York City, they just happened to come out with a PSA in New York City about what to do in case of a nuclear bomb. This is in 2022, last year. And this is, you know, from, you know, New York City actually put out this PSA that talked to people about, okay, well, if there's a nuclear bomb, go into your apartment, go into the middle of your apartment, and you'll be okay. So, you know, we thought the irony of including him, you know, what sort of spoke a lot to how far have we really come since, quote unquote, the Cold War. You know, where, you know, today they're actually still releasing videos to talk about that, you know, you can duck and cover and be safe from a nuclear detonation.
Continuing on that, What are downwinders, people in these downwind communities featured in the documentary, what are they dealing with now? I know we just talked about Arica and kind of the failures of that, but have other things improved?
I mean, I think the most important thing for downwinders is to get the word out of what's happening in this sort of unforgivable time in American history. And I think part of what I've heard from the downwinders that I've spoken to is that they're grateful that a conversation is starting. It's always one step forward, two steps back. This recent act that was passed, you know, for the military in Congress that, you know, actually had downwinder funds included in it, which is ironically put together by Senator Hawley. And I know we're all familiar with Senator Hawley in Missouri, and some of us who are progressives don't really like his politics. However, Hawley has been very, very active, an active supporter of the downwind community. And they took out all the funding. This is McConnell and Johnson. Mitch McConnell and Johnson took out all the downwinder funding from that, you know, ridiculously expensive act that's supporting defense, and yet it's really turning it back on downwinders. So it's a great question. I think what we're hoping is that the conversation has started. You know, we were really buoyed by Oppenheimer coming out because I think consciousness is raised about Oppenheimer and what happened with Oppenheimer and the tense moments within Oppenheimer. And, you know, our film coming out relatively soon after Oppenheimer came out is sort of, like you mentioned in the opening, we are the people that were impacted in the wake of Oppenheimer. We are all downwinders.
Maybe that even answers my next question I was going to have for you as you've looked into the story. I was going to ask you what are some things that surprised you, I suppose, to start out with Josh Hawley being a supporter of the downwinders would be one of them.
I mean, to me, that was huge. And actually, we did a few screenings last week in Portland, and we actually played an excerpt from Hawley, who's really, you know, actually, again, I think we all have the same feeling about him. However, again, with him, you find out, I think Mary Dixon, who from our film says, you know, politics makes for strange bedfellows. And it's true. You know, we are connected in that way. And hopefully in some ways, as we made this film, Doug and I, we were hoping that the film could be screened, you know, for Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Libertarians, anybody who has a vote and is a citizen of this world could watch and agree that 928 nuclear detonations is unacceptable. And I also think that it's interesting that a lot of people don't know, even in Portland, that, you know, this testing took place all the way up to 1991, and that the Nevada test site, which is a 1,350 square mile swath of land the size of Rhode Island in Nevada, that's all Shoshone Nation land, by the way, by treaty. There's a treaty that says this land belongs to the Shoshone Nation. But if you drive to the test site, even today, as I've done several times, there are fences around that land. And if you go up to the gate, they won't let you in, but they are going in and out with trucks and others, scientists and engineers, and people are still doing work there. And they're doing other things, but the Nevada test site remains restricted and operational. And I think the thing that gets me and others sort of scared, upset, is that we're hearing politicians talking about the resumption of testing, which is always a possibility. They haven't completely ratified the testing that could be done, and it could pick up at any moment. And there are Congress people in Congress and others who think that, you know, resuming testing is a good idea. So I guess I would be surprised by, you know, knowing and talking to the people and going into the living room of the homes of downwinders, you know, being welcomed into their homes and hearing their stories and going through photos of their kids and their grandchildren and others who are still have, you know, genetic impact from the testing. To me, that says a lot, and that there wasn't a governmental admission of guilt. I'm surprised that we haven't moved forward to, you know, abolish nuclear weapons, which is the goal.
What has been the response so far from the film? I know you mentioned some screenings in Portland. What have people been saying?
We've had really great response. We premiered in Park City in January in Utah, and which is really important for us to be in Utah because our film is so Utah-centric and Nevada-centric. And after that premiere, we've been at 15 festivals around the country and even in Australia England and a few other places, and it was very exciting. We got distribution from Gravitas Ventures at our first screening, which is challenging right now in this climate to get distribution for a documentary film. So we were incredibly enthusiastic, you know, about that, and we're currently in the Oscar shortlist. Listed as a shortlist hopeful, although it's, you know, it's a long shot because, you know, this film was a film that was made really by two people, and we didn't really have a marketing budget to compete with the big pay-to-play studios with our documentaries. But we've had great success. We've had tremendous help from folks like you mentioned, Matthew Modine and Adam Rakoff, who are Matthew Modine obviously is in Oppenheimer, and this is a near and dear subject to his heart. And, you know, we're just continuing to push forward. We are the mighty, or the little engine that could, I guess you would say. We're trying to do our best to get the word out there about our film, and, you know, how important it is just to, you know, even to get the conversation going.
If our listeners are interested in seeing the film for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, the beauty in Portland is you can see it on Comcast. If you just go to if you have one of those remotes where you can just speak into it and say downwind, it's available on Comcast. It's available on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, iTunes, Google Play, Microsoft, Redbox, Vudu, YouTube, Hoopla. It's really everywhere for video on demand. You can find it just about anywhere. I think iTunes and Amazon would be the easiest if you don't have Comcast Xfinity. And then if you go to our Instagram page, which is @downwind_film, we're constantly updating, you know, where you can watch the film, where you can see the film, and where we will be playing. We plan to have a lot of screenings coming up. We have some exciting screenings in, like as I mentioned, Portland and Las Vegas, where we screen with Dina Titus, who's a representative from the state of Nevada. In Portland, we had Representative Bonamici give an intro to our film, and we also, you know, we're going to be screening in Salt Lake on the National Day of Remembrance for Downwinders, which is January 27th. And again, everything will be updated either on our Instagram page that I mentioned @downwind_film or backlotdocs.com.
And Mark, as we wrap things up, do you have any final thoughts you'd like to, for our listeners?
I just think it's really important that this conversation is an open and honest conversation. I guess I was really excited when you mentioned Holly. I just, the fact that, you know, we actually have people in this world that we don't necessarily agree with, but there are certain subject matters that you know, he was really, really passionate about getting this out there. So I'm hoping that this becomes not an issue of your political affiliation, but just of your human decency, you know, that we all understand that, you know, the storage of nuclear waste, whether it's at Hanford or in Missouri or, you know, near the Nevada test site or, you know, from the detonations or in Russia, that to me was the one thing I want to leave. But also, I guess the other topic that I think was really interesting was the rise of sort of this activist and activism from unfamiliar places or unusual places, like Claudia Peterson, who's in our film, and she grew up a Mormon in Cedar City, Utah, small town, very, very conservative family. And then as you watch the film, you'll see what happens to her family based on you know, the testing where she lives near in St. George, Utah. And I guess I was excited about how she became an activist, and she's going around the world, and she's speaking to downwinder communities, you know, in Hiroshima, in Nevada, and also in Kazakhstan, where they did testing in Russia, where, you know, there are families there. There are people who are suffering that are downwinders there too. So this is a universal issue. And, you know, America, we like to take the lead. This is a place where Americans can take the lead, and we can be part of something exciting and part of something that, you know, that just says, you know, this is nuclear testing worldwide is unacceptable.
Well, I think those are both fantastic sentiments to wrap things up on. Mark, thank you again for stopping by KABU News in Depth.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for the time. I love KABU and I love being here. Thank you.
Thanks. I've been speaking with Mark Shapiro, the co-director of the documentary Downwind. It's the story of the enduring effects of 928 large-scale nuclear weapon detonations between 1951 and 1992 in Nevada, specifically on Shoshone Native land. It specifically deals with those living downwind of the test site. A trailer and more information on the documentary can be found online at backlotdocs.com. You're listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Stay with us.
KABU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KABU News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. In the early 1990s, the Japanese itinerant artist Kenji Kawakami found himself the editor of Mail Order Life, a shopping catalog geared towards suburban housewives. The magazine, under Kawakami's guidance, became a showcase for a variety of bizarre objects invented by the editor. Kawakami described these objects with a self-invented term, chindogu. Literally translating to unusual tool, Kawakami himself preferred the English translation of weird tool. Chindogu is the art of the not commercially viable object, an object whose usefulness is undermined by its absurdity. Chindogu is also the subject of a new art exhibition currently on display at the Ace Hotel. The show, titled Curious Objects, features local artists grappling with Kawakami's revolutionary art form. Myself and KABU's Althea Billings spoke with the co-founders of Ethereal Reflections, the Portland pop-up gallery collective who curated the exhibition, as well as one of the artists involved on the exhibition's opening night. Do you mind introducing yourselves?
I'm Lena Vasilenko.
And I'm Emma Sugar.
And also maybe introduce your pop-up exhibit group.
We are at Ethereal Reflections, Curious Objects, celebrating the Japanese art of chindogu.
And where do we find ourselves right now?
We are currently standing in a breezy street outside of Ace Hotel at the old Kenny and Zook space, which we have taken over.
2860 Southwest Harvey Milk Street.
Yeah, trying to reduce the sounds of traffic and passerbys. So we just stepped out from your really cool exhibit on chindogu. Do you mind just giving like a brief introduction of the term chindogu for people that might not know?
Chindogu actually stands for Curious Objects. Chin, Curious, Dogu, Objects. So we decided to name it Curious Objects. And the concept is to celebrate useless, useful pieces. So silly objects that would be amazing in one way, but also ridiculous in a different way.
And how did you come up with, you know, how did you come to the idea of making an exhibit about chindogu? What kind of drew you to the term, I guess?
I've had a book, 101 Useless Inventions, and it was by a Japanese artist who just made silly things, for example, umbrellas over shoes so your feet don't get wet, or a fan right next to the chopsticks to cool your noodles as you're slurping them. There is a humor in it, and I think that something that we like to celebrate at Ethereal Reflections is to break down the stiffness of art and having a playful theme, something that you can't take seriously. One of the rules of chindogu is you're not allowed to sell it. You can't trademark it. You can't put it out there. You can't make any money out of it. And so that's what the show is. It's like, no, this is just for fun. It's an escape from the world. It's a really creative process for all the artists involved who just can think of anything in this world to make work.
Do either of you have any pieces in the current exhibit?
Oh my gosh, yeah, we have multiple.
Do you mind maybe describing one of them?
Sure, yeah. I made a clock that's made up of a dozen watches. So for each like number on the clock, it would be a watch that would be set to the specific hour and second of the number on the clock. So it's sort of like a meta clock. Within every like minute, there's another minute. With every second, there's another second. So it's a way to be very on time. And then I also have a goldfish purse in case you ever wanted to take your goldfish out with you.
With a live goldfish in it.
Yes, yeah. Jean-Jacques Rousseau is the name of my goldfish. He's a genius. And then I have an instant garden, which is essentially a way to make your garden fresh all the time, no matter what.
Can you say what the I really like the instant garden. You mind just giving a brief description of that too?
Sure, yeah. So it's a garden bed full of dirt, But within the dirt, there's like six vases that are full of water. So you could hypothetically replace them with individual stems of flowers all the time for company or yourself or whoever to have fresh flowers whenever in your garden, even though you couldn't grow them hypothetically necessarily. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Chindogu book, that Kenji Kawakama. Do you have any favorite Chindogus out of that book?
I think my very favorite is the lipstick applicator. It's a frame that you always just have the perfect lipstick. And I think it just goes by to show just how forever we've been chasing the perfect lip.
Yeah.
Well, nice. Is this your first exhibit with Ethereal Reflections, or what previous ones have you done?
Our first one was actually right down the street in the old cleaner space, which was actually 11 months ago to the day, in January, which were just a group show. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had two in January that were two group shows. One of them was just traditional, and then the other one was more of like an AI oriented one. Yeah, and then we've done, you know, sporadic ones since then, but this is our first like semi-permanent space since then.
What do you hope people get out of it when they come to see it? What do you want them to walk away with?
I want people to realize art is fun, and I think that art is also something that creates culture and it creates community. Just looking through the windows, you can see how many new friendships can be formed or how many new connections are built. And I think that that's what art is. And that's what I want people. I want people to give it a try. Go to a show, build something, try something, find that, because I think everybody is an artist. So find something that you can do.
People want to find more information about Ethereal Reflections or about this exhibit, where can they go?
www.etherealreflections.online or at ethereal_reflections on Instagram.
All right, Emma, Lena, thank you so much for speaking with me and speaking with KBOO.
Thank you.
Do you mind introducing yourself first for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. My name is India. I'm an installation artist and writer.
And India, you have a piece here in the Ethereal Reflections Chindogu exhibit. Do you mind introducing your piece, maybe saying a little bit about it?
Yeah, so for this show, I created what I like to call feelings crown. It is a crown you can wear on your head, and you swap out different words based on how you're feeling that day, and you can let other people know how you're feeling without them even having to talk to you.
And how do you feel like that's a reflection of the tenets of Chindogu?
Well, it's really definitely helpful, because I think that it would be great for a lot of people to not have to actually vocally say how they actually feel internally. You know, you say, I'm fine to most people, but that's probably not actually how you're doing. But realistically, it's very impractical, because one, I tried to make the crown an impractical piece in itself just through how ornate the crown is and how many different components there are to it. But also, you know, in reality, it's probably not how a conversation with the average person is going to go. They're probably not going to pay attention to like a really crazy crown you're wearing on your head. One of my favorite things about the Chindogu tenets also is the anarchy piece. Like, one of the tenets is like, oh, it needs to be like anarchy related. And I think letting people know very publicly and abrasively how you're feeling for the day, especially if it's, for example, the word I used on my installation, melancholic, is kind of a radical thing, you know, to be very open about how intense you're feeling on any given day or how horrible or how good. We don't often talk about our feelings very publicly as a society, so I like to think that it is really attached to that tenet of Chindogu in that way, too.
It's so funny. I was just going to bring up that anarchy, yeah, tenet.
It's so good. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite other installation of this exhibit so far?
Oh my gosh, I do. Well, I have two. I love the bread and butter one, where the candles are like edible butter candles melting into the bread. That one's amazing. And then Emma, one of the curators, created a little purse for a goldfish that you can take around as like an emotional, what did she say? Like a, what was the word? Oh, when you have like an emotional animal, what's it called?
Emotional support animal.
Emotional support animal, goldfish. And I love that one. I think the idea is really cute and funny. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure that goldfish is not going to be in here very long and he's only here like for the night. But in theory, yes, it would be great to be able to carry a goldfish around everywhere. I'm a Pisces, so I feel like it would really speak to my inner soul to do that.
Do you have any other, if you didn't create the feelings crown, what other Chindogu ideas did you have in mind for this exhibit?
Oh my gosh, this was the first one that popped into my head, honestly, and I didn't have that many others because I've been waiting to create a piece like this, actually. I make installations using words and I hang them in public places, but the idea of having a public piece actually live on a person and be able to parade it around, like anywhere you physically are, not just in one space, is something I've been wanting to do for a really long time. So honestly, this was the only idea I had. I was just so excited to make it.
What do you hope people get out of your piece, people that are seeing it?
I hope that they feel more comfortable talking about their feelings very openly and publicly.
Nice. And if people want to find more of your work, where can they find it?
Oh, I'm on Instagram, like everyone. My Instagram is @heartbread, because my name is India, and it's impossible to get that name on any social media platform.
That was Emma and Lena, co-founders of Ethereal Reflections, the Portland Pop-Up Gallery Collective, and India, an installation artist and writer. We spoke with them on the opening night of Ethereal Reflections exhibition, Curious Objects, which featured the works of India and other local artists based on the artistic principle of Chindogu. To close out, here's some audio taken from inside the event.
We've got a marriage lease by Karina Gonzalez. For those who feel that marriage vows oftentimes get revoked, enter the marriage lease, a foolproof way to update the agreements, the relationship every few years. They've got some nice stipulations, remote work arrangements.
For Cable News in Depth, I'm Reed Johnson.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.